You're listening to NBC Sports Radio, and this is Pro Football Talk Live with Mike Florio, where every day is game day.
Let's go get it.
Oh, three, one, two, three.
Now, here's your host, Mike Florio.
It's PFT Live on NBC Sports Radio, February 6th, 5 days removed from the Super Bowl, but the fumes continue to linger. The fanning of the flames by the Patriots fans who are scouring the internet for any possible evidence of anything that would call into question any of the criticisms that the Patriots have absorbed in recent days. And that's fair game, because there have been examples of other teams cheating, and there have been examples, at least one fairly big example, of a guy who has thrown stones at the Patriots residing in a house made of glass. Hall of Famer Jerry Rice, friend of the program. I apply that to anybody who's been on more than once, because I assume if they've been on once and they have made it through me being who I am and come back again, they must not hate me. Jerry Rice may hate me now for pointing out that Jerry Rice, before suggesting that an asterisk should apply to the latest Lombardi trophy secured by the New England Patriots because of the hashtag Deflategate scandal, Rice admitted to spraying stickum on his gloves. Now, there's a problem with that, because gloves started being used after stickum was outlawed. Stickum used to be the way that guys like Fred Biletnikoff, Lester Hayes, and others would assist in the catching of a football. Stickum goes away, enter the gloves, and laughingly, in an ESPN feature that just had snippets of comments from guys like Rice and James Lofton and modern-day receivers, that snippet was damning. In that snippet, Jerry Rice speaks with a laugh of using stickum, and this might be a little illegal. Well, it might be a lot illegal. So we posted on it. It was an intriguing contrast to his comments about the Patriots, and you can take his words about the Patriots and you can use those same words about Rice. He still would have been one of the greatest receivers of all time. Wait, the greatest receiver of all time. One of the greatest players of all time in any position. He still would have had the Super Bowl rings. He still would have had the stats. But he had that edge. Now, Jerry Rice, and we're trying to get him on the program, he may say, well, everybody was doing it. Fine. That's what the Patriots fans and supporters will say. And that's the bottom line here. I've tried to illustrate the point all week long. If the Patriots were cheating with Deflategate, they're not the only team that was doing it. We've seen the anecdotal evidence through the last 3 weeks. Guys like Jeff Blake, that was just ignored last week. Maybe because Jeff Blake wasn't one of the top quarterbacks in the game when he played. Jeff Blake admitting that deflating footballs was a routine occurrence. Brad Johnson admitting that he gave a $7,500 tip, not a bribe, but a tip, to the ball boys responsible for the 100 footballs before Super Bowl 37. The list goes on and on, whether it's tampering, whether it's injury reports, and whether it's Jerry Rice spraying stickum on his gloves in violation of the rules. I expected that by now there'd be something more from Jerry Rice. My comments were taken out of context. It was a joke, etc. We'd love to get him on the program to talk about it, because the way that feature on ESPN was produced, and it was a feature about the evolution of gloves, it was just that little piece with no follow-up. Maybe there was follow-up that didn't make it. Maybe he later said, oh, that's just a joke. Maybe he said, don't use that. We don't know, because we don't have the raw copy of the interview. And I think somebody, whether it's me or anyone else, should have a chance to talk to him a little bit more about it. I think it's fair to Rice for him to have an opportunity to explain. But that one snippet that Patriots fans have been parading around and ultimately was sent to me by multiple Patriots fans, and probably would have been sent many more times if I didn't write the story, and probably will be sent even though I have written the story, doesn't look good for Jerry Rice, especially in light of his criticism of the Patriots. It probably doesn't look all that good for Adrian Peterson to be reinstated before April 15, but he's going to court today to attack the upholding of his 6-game suspension, along with a requirement from the NFL that he be suspended until April 15, and that's when his case for reinstatement will first be considered. Now, when Peterson filed the lawsuit, no effort was made to force him back onto the field through what they call a preliminary injunction. And we've seen other players, other Vikings players, Kevin and Pat Williams, both formerly of the Vikings, using that device to stay on the field while the lawsuit unfolds. Adrian Peterson could have done that, but he was at a point in December where he didn't want to play in 2014. He wants to play in 2015. He will play in 2015, barring something unexpected. So why is he forcing his way back in before April 15 when the offseason program for the Vikings and every other team doesn't begin until late April? Well, apart from wanting to push back against the NFL's over-the-top application of the rules, and this is part of the broader fight between the league and the players' union, Adrian Peterson wants to be reinstated by March 10, not April 15. Well, it's only a month. What's a big deal? Nothing's going on. Well, something is going on. March 10 is the start of the new league year. And if Adrian Peterson is going to be sent to a new team, either via trade or release from the Vikings, that month makes a big difference. From March 10 to April 15, that's more than enough time for the Cowboys to have to make a final decision, for example, on DeMarco Murray. And if the Cowboys don't know that they're going to have a shot at Adrian Peterson until April 15, they're either going to sign DeMarco Murray to a new contract or make other arrangements at the running back position, which would make them less inclined to try to trade for Adrian Peterson. And you're taking a leap of faith if he's not reinstated March 10, that he will be reinstated come the middle of April, because you have to at least consider the possibility that the NFL won't appreciate the fact that litigation was pursued and maybe won't reinstate him on April 15, find some other reason for keeping him out a while longer. But I think that's the end game here. That's the goal. Adrian Peterson wants to be reinstated by March 10 so he can be traded. The Cowboys have to be in play. They have to be. The moment that I saw DeMarco Murray complain about running into an 8- and 9-man front in the game that Tony Romo was unable to play and Brandon Weedham got the start and they loaded the box to stop DeMarco Murray, my reaction was, well, welcome to Adrian Peterson's entire career. I mean, except for the first year of the Brett Favre tenure in Minnesota, there hasn't been a passing game to complement Adrian Peterson. It's been 8- and 9-man fronts for Adrian Peterson, and he's continued to be one of the greatest running backs of all time. You put him with Tony Romo and that offensive line, even though he's older than DeMarco Murray, I think most would take Adrian Peterson over DeMarco Murray. And I think Jerry Jones would love to get Adrian Peterson if he can. If he could get Adrian Peterson, he could let Dez Bryant walk too. And he could draft a receiver in the bottom of round one. A lot of great first round receivers last year. Find another guy like a young Dez Bryant. Pay him a lot less money. Look, Sidney Rice became a great receiver with Adrian Peterson and Brett Favre. What'd Sidney Rice ever do without Brett Favre and Adrian Peterson? So that's really the issue here. That's the goal. Get Adrian Peterson reinstated by March 10 and then see what happens. And another team to keep an eye on, because the Cardinals have Larry Fitzgerald. They may not be able to work out a deal with Larry Fitzgerald on a new contract. Fitzgerald was a ball boy for the Vikings back in the 90s. If the Vikings are going to part with Adrian Peterson, they almost need to balance that with a big push, a big splash. Bring home Larry Fitzgerald. Why not trade Adrian Peterson for Larry Fitzgerald straight up? Think of what he'd do for the Cardinals, and think of what Fitzgerald could do for the Vikings. Plenty of other opportunities, plenty of teams will be interested in Adrian Peterson, but from the Vikings' standpoint, if they believe Peterson wants to move on, the sooner he's reinstated, the better chance they have to get real value for him. The New England Patriots got real value out of the 2014 season. They won it all, and there have been so many quotes and comments this week from owner Robert Kraft. We haven't heard much from Coach Bill Belichick, but we're going to. Amazingly, Bill Belichick is going to be a guest on David Letterman's show next week. And look, I love David Letterman's show. I haven't been able to watch much of it lately because it's been kind of busy. I have a feeling that the Deflategate thing has come up once or twice or 50 times in David Letterman's monologue. I don't know why Belichick is doing this. I like that he's doing it. I don't know why he's doing it. Do we expect him to be any different than he ever is? It's fascinating, though, to think of what can happen, what will come up, what will be said if and when, well, when. And I guess we still have to say if, because there's a chance it could all fall through. Belichick on David Letterman's show should be interesting. And remember, several years ago, Letterman made some news. Brett Favre was on after he had retired the first time, and that was the first occasion for Favre to say things that suggested to some, this guy's not done playing football. And later that year, he was back playing football. Meanwhile, Robert Kraft, still angry about Deflategate, still convinced that nothing happened, and we're still waiting for the official report as the NFL tries to find a way out of this minefield that the commissioner is now in the middle of. Because if you hammer the Patriots, say farewell to the relationship with one of the most influential owners, one of the three owners who decides how much money Roger Goodell makes. And if you don't hammer the Patriots, here come the accusations of favorable treatment and whitewashing and looking the other way and trying to find an excuse for something that people have already become convinced happened. And that's the problem here. Everybody's already locked into their opinions on Deflategate without facts. We're going to have the facts in a matter of weeks. Will we be willing to change our opinions based on those facts, or will we simply pick and choose which facts support our opinions and ignore the rest? Still a lot of fascinating stuff to come. And in the coming week, it will be Bill Belichick tentatively scheduled to join David Letterman on Wednesday. More than tentatively scheduled to join this program today, the great and unparalleled Fred Godelli, the producer of Sunday Night Football on NBC, the producer of Super Bowl 49. You will not want to miss that kind of inside baseball, or really inside football, inside broadcasting look at what goes into that broadcast, how difficult it is, how demanding it is. Should be a great conversation coming up with Fred. We'll talk to Tyler Dunn of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel later in the hour. A lot of Packers news this week. We have Brandon Browner. He was sick yesterday. He's healthy today. Top of hour two. And plenty of other stuff to come. We'll talk to you along the way. We'll talk to you anytime. 855-323-4NBC. We'll be back with more PFT Live on NBC Sports Radio. Welcome back to PFT Live on NBC Sports Radio. The other day, we had on the program the best play-by-play announcer in broadcasting, perhaps one of the best of all time. So it's fitting to take a peek behind the curtain and talk to the best producer in sports broadcasting and perhaps the best producer of all time, NBC's Fred Godelli. Fred, how many Emmys do you have and where do you keep them?
They're in my
basement. And how can I steal one?
They're in my basement, and I actually feel guilty about them because they're the work of hundreds and hundreds of people, not just me. But I thank you for those kind words, Mike.
How many?
18.
Oh, boy. That's a big basement.
Not as big as Dick Ebersol's, but yeah.
Yeah. How many Super Bowls, Fred, have you produced, and where does this one rank for you?
This was my fifth with Drew Esikoff, our director, and the rest of our crew. It's funny. It's got to be right at the top. For some reason, that Pittsburgh-Arizona one always stands out to me as well. But it's obviously right there with, you know, Pittsburgh-Arizona and the way that game unfolded and the way that game ended. But it was a fantastic game because, you know, other than the beginning of the game for Seattle, there wasn't a lot of ebb to that game. You know, once we hit the 2-minute warning of the first half, it was complete flow in terms of the play on the field. So it was it was a privilege to do that one.
He's Fred Godelli, producer of Sunday Night Football on NBC and produced Super Bowl 49. What's the biggest difference between producing a Super Bowl and producing a regular season Sunday night game?
Well, I mean, you're aware of there's, you know, in this case, would we end up with 114 million people? So, you know, normally we're doing, you know, 22 million people. So you could do the math there. There's millions, millions, millions more people. And most of those people don't follow the NFL very closely and may not even be football fans. But because this day has become an American holiday, you know that, you know, there's going to be a lot of those people watching the game. And while you don't dumb it down for the football fan, you do try to make it a little bit broader and maybe show some things or do some things. I wouldn't say that you don't normally do, but you have those people in mind. So if it's telling a few more stories or, you know, actually, you know, showing what these players look like or showing shots of the Grand Canyon, whatever it is, you're trying to do that really just to hook those other people and, you know, make it an enjoyable experience for them as well, Mike.
What's the most important part of your preparation to go into the truck and handle a Super Bowl?
You know, I mean, not so different from the team is, as you know, there is just so many distractions at the Super Bowl. It's very easy to get caught up in all the hoopla and forget why it is that you're there. And you're there to cover the game as well as it can be covered. So for me, the most important part of the preparation is actually forgetting the hoopla and really focusing in on, you know, what it is that we have to do. And, you know, this is a game where we add probably, you know, 25 new crew members to our team who haven't been with us all year. A lot of those people have worked with us in the past and, you know, various shows or even some Super Bowls. But, you know, to make sure they understand, hey, this is how we do it. This is what we like. This is what your assignment is. And, you know, this is how we need you to execute it. So, you know, for me, it's just trying to really hone in on the two teams, how the game is going to be played, make sure Al, Chris, and Michelle, you know, have everything that they need to be comfortable, and really make sure that everyone on the show understands what their assignment is on a play-to-play basis. And that's, to me, the most important.
He's Fred Godelli, producer of Sunday Night Football on NBC. There was one moment that created some mild discomfort during the game, and this is how you and I got in contact this week, the Doug Baldwin touchdown celebration. Walk us through what happened and why a replay of that notorious moment never made it onto 114 million TV screens.
Sure, and I'm going to give this to you from Drew Esikov's perspective, who's the director, and then my perspective as the producer of the show. So when that touchdown is scored, immediately I'm communicating with Chris Collinsworth. Chris is saying to me, hey, Revis got picked by the umpire. And I'm saying to Chris, but the play-action fake was tremendous as well. So while we're communicating on that, and I'm looking at those two replays, Drew is now cutting the live action. So Baldwin scores. He spins the ball. And Drew now is kind of taking his eyes off of Baldwin because now he's going to capture the perspective of that score from a variety of people. Tom Brady had thrown the interception that led to that touchdown. So Brady was the next shot. And then he comes back to Baldwin, and Baldwin already done what he did. But Drew didn't see Baldwin do that, and I didn't see him do it till we got to the commercial. Now, Al says, hey, they just flagged the Seahawks for excessive celebration, and I thought it was because, you know, he had spun the ball and there were a bunch of guys there with him, and that's what I thought it was for. So we get into the commercial, and now I'm watching the replays, and I'm looking at Baldwin and what he's doing. I'm like, you got to be kidding me. The first thing in my mind is, this guy went to Stanford and he graduated. What is he doing? So I look at him, I'm like, you know what? The heck with this. I'm moving on. You know, now, if that penalty had proven to be game-changing, where the Patriots got the ball, I forget where they ended up getting the football back, the 35 or the 40, and they drove down and they scored, I probably would have had to come back with it.
But hey, Fred?
Yeah.
Can you hang around? I don't want to end on Poopgate, but I got to take a hard break. Can you hang around
and we'll continue the discussion?
All right. We'll be back with more PFT Live on NBC Sports Radio. Welcome back to PFT Live on NBC Sports Radio. Kind enough to stick around, NBC Sunday Night Football producer Fred Godelli, after a week in which he has to be exhausted. Fred, how much did you sleep last week?
No. Mike, I only sleep 5 hours a night, 6 hours on a good night regularly. So it really wasn't much different last week.
The even in the off season, you're still 5 hours?
Yeah,
what are you doing in the off season?
I'm not a great sleeper, man. I guess it comes with old age. I just don't sleep that well. I sleep hard for about 5 hours, sometimes six, and that's about it. I'm up.
Oh. Is this a prostate thing you're talking about, or what?
No, actually, it's not, man. It's not a prostate thing. It's just like, that's all I can go. I mean, I just, trust me, I have great envy for people who get the 8 hours and sleep. Me, not me.
What does Fred Godelli do in the half of the year that isn't football season?
Well, you know, I work with Mark Lazarus on politicking and pleading for our schedule for next year, and that's you know, that's a pretty important thing, especially when you're only doing one game a week. So that takes up February, March, and a little bit of April. And I go back and I try to watch, you know, a lot of the Sunday night games that we just did to try to figure out, you know, things that need to be improved for next year, and, you know, try to come up with some type of innovation on a yearly basis. But it's really kind of downtime because from Canton to the Super Bowl, it's 7 days a week, you know, without a break. So it's a good time to recharge, but I do try to use that time and just, you know, catch up on all the stuff you can't do. Go see a few movies, read a lot of books, you know, all the things normal people do, Mike, which I know you don't do either.
Well, that's right, and it never ends. And in the off season, as you're explaining, it doesn't end either because it's always all about football. You mentioned
well, you don't
the
have
process.
An I mean, that's
no,
absurd.
2 weeks in June. 2 weeks in June, maybe three. The process of getting the schedule in place, you mentioned politicking, and we hear those
right.
stories from time to time. How much does that actually make a difference at the end of the day? Because you've got NBC, CBS, Fox, ESPN, everybody pulling for the games they want. Does it matter in the end?
Well, look, here's the deal. I mean, there's probably 20 to 25, you know, really great matchups going into a season that you can predict, you know, for next year. So, like, you know, the Steelers will play the Seahawks next year. It's Manning, Brady, 17 next year. It's, you know, Green Bay, Seattle next year. There's a lot of great games out there, and we all want the same games. So, you know, Howard Katz, who's the executive vice president of broadcasting at the NFL, you know, he just does a, to me, miraculous job of balancing, you know, all the different politicking from the various networks that are going on and giving everyone a lot of what they want, but no one gets everything they want. So, but it's big because you have to make your case and you have to, you know, keep, you know, pounding the door like, we really need this game, we really need this game, and make a compelling reason why.
He's Fred Godelli of NBC, producer of Sunday Night Football, producer of Super Bowl 49. You mentioned before the break the Doug Baldwin
right.
routine after the Super Bowl, and yeah, he went to Stanford, he graduated from Stanford, and that made me wonder, Fred, give me a guy who, behind closed doors, when you meet with him, when you talk to him, is so much different than the public perception or the public reality of that player.
Well,
or coach.
I'm going to stay on that team. I'm probably going to say Richard Sherman. I know Chris and Al would agree with me on this, and Michelle would too. You know, there are certain guys that, you know, whenever you have them in the room, it's informative, it's entertaining, you learn something. I mean, Richard Sherman is probably a smart and engaging a person with great perspective on a wide variety of topics outside of football, you know, as anyone, you know, that we meet. And it's really enjoyable when we get the chance to meet with him. He's very real. He's incredibly smart. He has a way of getting right to the nub. I think, as most people would probably agree with that, you know, based on some of the comments he made during Super Bowl week. But I think people probably have the wrong perception of this guy based on the post game of, you know, last year's NFC Championship game against the 49ers. But I mean, I really, really, and like I said, Al, Chris, and Michelle would join me in this. We really love talking to him.
He's Fred Godelli of NBC, producer of Sunday Night Football, producer of Super Bowl 49. There is ongoing talk, Fred, about expanded use of instant replay for NFL games. Where do you stand on that possibility of more, not less, instant replay?
Well, I mean, look, I can understand why coaches would want to open up that box to include more plays. But here's my take. This is from a television perspective. When a touchdown is scored right now, we don't celebrate a touchdown. We investigate a touchdown. And the amount of time between when the person actually crosses the goal line and we kick the extra point seem to get longer and longer and longer as the season went on. And in the postseason, to me, it was interminable. I mean, Marshawn Lynch's touchdown in the Super Bowl, I went and timed it from the time he crossed the goal line until the time we kicked the extra point, it was almost 2 minutes. Now, the first replay, you can see Marshawn Lynch's knee is not on the ground. He has gotten into the end zone cleanly. And I just think that the way replay has taken over the game is not what anyone intended. Now, I know, in speaking to Belichick, you know, he wants everything, including pass interference, you know, helmet-to-helmet contact. He wants every single thing that can be called into in a football game subject to review, not increase the amount of challenges, but, you know, have everything in the game subject to reviewing it. And I guess I could go with that, but somehow we've got to get you know, a hold of instant replay and bring it back what it was meant to be, and that was to correct bad calls. You know, not to investigate every turnover, not to investigate every touchdown. I mean, to me, it's ruining the flow of the game. I mean, I'm a big believer in that it's truly ruining the flow of the game.
He's Fred Gadelli, NBC Sunday Night Football producer. When you look back on your career, whether with NBC, ESPN, ABC, what's the one game that you're the most proud of?
That's a hard one. I'd probably go back to Super Bowl 43, where you had some of the greatest plays in the history of the game, with, you know, starting with James Harrison's 100-yard interception return. I might say I did the Music City Miracle game for ABC, you know, back in 1999. But I think the most memorable game I did was the Monday night game when Brett Favre's dad had passed away the night before, and to see someone perform like that under, you know, one of the most trying moments of your life. You lose your dad. In Brett's case, he lost him very unexpectedly, and then to come out and perform the way he performed, that to me was probably the most memorable game I've ever done.
Last one for you, Fred, and we appreciate so much your time today. I notice some excellent bumper music choices from time to time. How much time do you actually spend on selecting the music library for a given game?
Well, there was a great article about this in the Wall Street Journal. That 99% of that is done by our head audio technician, Wendell Stevens, who, well, I would tell you, I think he had 75 cuts ready for the Super Bowl, just based on potential situations that could occur or things for certain players and things of that nature. But, you know, during the off season, I'll make a list throughout the off season. I'll hear a song, I'll put it on the list. And then come July, I'll send him a list of probably, you know, 50 songs. But really, that's his work, that's his genius, and he deserves all the credit for it.
Well, it's great stuff, and you deserve a ton of credit for holding it all together and making it all happen. Congratulations on another great season. Look forward to seeing you in the offseason.
Mike, same here. Continued success to you as well.
Thanks, pal. Fred Gadelli, producer of Sunday Night Football, producer of Super Bowl 49. When we return, a team that almost made it to Super Bowl 49, the Green Bay Packers. Tyler Dunn with an update from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel on some of the various things still swirling around that franchise. We'll be back with more PFT Live on NBC Sports Radio.
You have to remember that you represent the Packers at all times, and we talk about a lot what it means to be a Packer and to do things the Packer way. You know, LeTroy is a free agent right now, but I know that we were thinking about bringing him back. That's what the word seemed to be. So I'm not sure how that's going to change with this arrest, but we love LeTroy, and you know, I think in times like this, you need to come around a teammate like that instead of pointing the finger or turning your back to him.
That's Aaron Rodgers, Packers quarterback, talking about Packers defensive lineman LeTroy Guyon, who was arrested this week. And just a quick reminder, Pro Football Talk Live on NBC Sports Radio is built by the Home Depot. Got an idea, let's do this smarter and for less, more saving, more doing. That's the power of the Home Depot. Joining us now to shed further light on the Guyon arrest and other issues that have emerged in recent days regarding the Green Bay Packers, our good friend Tyler Dunn of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Tyler, let's start with LeTroy Guyon. What do we know as of this moment about what he's facing and what the Packers' view of him is?
Right now, it obviously does not look good for LeTroy Guyon. He stopped for a failure to maintain a single lane, and they smell the odor of the marijuana, obviously, and what's found is 357 grams of marijuana, about 3/4 of a pound $190,028.81 to be exact, and a 9mm semi-automatic. So he's arrested, and it doesn't look good. Now, his agent did come out and say that the gun was recently and illegally purchased by Guyon, and in terms of the money, he was going to help out some family members in Florida, provide some financial assistance, all of that. He did not address the marijuana, but, you know, in terms of the money, you know, that would seem to be his case, and that here's a guy who had a pretty rough upbringing. Biological father left him when he was one, and his stepfather, Guyon told me earlier this season, was never around, was involved in the streets heavily, usually high on drugs. He was really the man of the household as early as 14, 15, and had four younger siblings. So like a lot of other NFL players, rough upbringing. So, you know, hypothetically, you know, it makes a little bit of sense that maybe he wanted to provide some financial support for a bunch of his family members. You know, obviously that's just not the way you want to do it, just carrying around $190,000. Still no explanation for the marijuana. And as far as the Packers are concerned, Mike, he's a free agent. You know, this is the kind of thing that hasn't happened in a while. Their last arrest, November 2011, they like to steer clear of these type of situations. I would think that they lean toward keeping B.J. Raji and moving on with maybe somebody else too.
He's Tyler Dunn of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. At the top of the segment, we played Aaron Rodgers from ESPN Milwaukee talking about LaTroy Guyon. During that same radio broadcast, Rodgers talked about his calf injury, blamed it on the turf at Raymond James Stadium. You view that as a legitimate complaint, or Rodgers just being upset and looking for something to point a finger at?
You know, I've never been on the turf at Raymond James Stadium and don't know a heck of a lot about it. It seems like a pretty nice stadium, pretty nice facility. Things are fairly new. It's probably a combination of everything you just said, where he's probably not pleased with what he had to deal with, but I don't know. I have to think there are worse field surfaces out there, and there definitely have been years past. And in 2015, you know, teams do a pretty good job with fields, and unless that team is Soldier Field, you hear a lot of complaints about that. Hard to say. I mean, he's the quarterback that dealt with it. I'd imagine it affected him to some degree if he had something to say about it.
Rodgers also had something to say about the importance of home field advantage. The team unbeaten at Lambeau Field in 2014 lost on the road in spectacular and depressing fashion for Packers fans to the Seattle Seahawks. How reasonable is it, based on the schedule for the Packers in 2015, for this team to emerge with home field advantage throughout the playoffs?
Whew, boy, that's a loaded question. You know, this loss, this game is going to linger. And the one that comes to mind is they've had a bunch of these postseason kind of crushing losses. But, you know, a decade ago, they lost in that fourth and 26 game. And talking to some guys on that team, you know, the loss has an effect on you. It's something you don't forget. You can't shake it loose. And, you know, that team started 1-4 the next year. They did rally. They won the division at 10-6. But to come so close to the Super Bowl, to knock at the doorstep and not be able to finish, they're not going to forget about this game anytime soon. Now, from a football perspective, personnel standpoint, they've got the team, and they keep Julius Peppers around. They're able to re-sign Cobb and or Bulaga, a huge decision to make a cornerback there. Tremont Williams is still the top of his game and turns 32 here. They can get through these decisions effectively. Yeah, they do have the roster to get home field advantage, and as we saw, that can be the difference. You know what they should do? Preemptively sign Kyle Orton. He's been the thorn in this team's side. You know, that's the reason they didn't have home field advantage last season.
He's Tyler Dunn, Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, last minute or two. How much of that loss still resonates with the organization? We're nearly 3 weeks removed from it, and since then the Seahawks have had an even more spectacular loss. Where is the Packers fan mindset right now?
Yeah, I think that in a weird kind of way might have helped the fans and even the players themselves. You saw guys like David Bakhtiari and TJ Lang tweeting immediately after that Seattle-New England game that to see them kind of go through an equally crushing loss in a different way maybe helps them to an extent. But, it is a long offseason. Eventually, they'll come back, and every team is different. You know, that's the thing. For better and worse, every team in the NFL is different every single season. So in that sense, they just have to turn the page from that game. Or else, you know what, they'll start sluggish. It's the NFL, and things can change in a hurry for all.
Well, great stuff, Tyler. We'll talk to you again down the road, buddy. Thanks for some of your time.
Hey, you got it. Anytime. Thanks a lot.
And it was an amazing chain of misery from the Seahawks and their loss in the Super Bowl, the Packers loss, and then the Packers win over the Cowboys, miserable for the Cowboys. Cowboys win over the Lions, miserable for the Lions, but it does hurt more the deeper you get into the postseason. So maybe the Packers feel a little bit better now that they've seen the Seahawks flame out in far more spectacular fashion. We'll be back. Speaking of the Seahawks, we'll be talking to Patriots cornerback Brandon Brown, our unsung hero of Super Bowl 49. We'll be back. This is PFT Live on NBC Sports Radio. Hour number two on this Friday, PFT Live on NBC Sports Radio. And from the moment Super Bowl 49 ended, there is one guy I've wanted to talk to. One guy and one guy only. Not Tom Brady, not Bill Belichick, not Pete Carroll. I'll let Matt Lauer talk to Pete Carroll. The guy that I believe is the unsung hero of Super Bowl 49 and deserves far more credit, if not that Chevy truck, if not the MVP trophy, cornerback Brandon Browner, and he joins us now. How's that for an introduction, Brandon?
Wow, man, appreciate the love.
Well, hey, you now have two Super Bowl rings. You got one last year from the Seahawks. You have one this year from the Patriots eventually. Is it acceptable to wear both of them at the same time since they come from different teams?
I don't wear stuff like that. I tend to lock stuff like that up, you know, save it for memories down the road. You know, hopefully I can keep just putting them away, locking them up, you know.
Well, in the latest one, you'll get it in time. Before that was the parade. What was the craziest thing you saw at the Patriots parade?
I actually didn't go to the parade, man. I was a little under the weather.
Well, we appreciate you, and I know you were under the weather yesterday. We tried to get you then. Appreciate you making time for us today. He's Brandon Browner, Patriots cornerback. Let's focus on that final play, the interception. Before the play, I see you, and I've watched the replay 100 times now, telling Malcolm Butler where to go. What were you specifically communicating to him and why before the snap?
I was just letting him know, you know, what a line. We're man-to-man, you know, in that particular play. And, you know, we know them. They run a lot of pick plays, which are man-to-man beaters, you know. You know, when they stack the receivers, so you never know which guy was going to be the pick guy. So we know this week we were going to get up there and press one of the guys, you know. And usually it was the guy on the ball or number two receiver. But because they were stacked, you know, it gives you, you know, it's hard to tell who's one, who's two, you know. So what I did is just press the guy on the ball. And it gave Malcolm some time to get over and close on his man.
Had you ever seen that formation in that circumstance in practice with the Seahawks when you were a member of the team?
Yeah, most definitely.
And how much did that help you know what was coming on that play in the Super Bowl?
I think just watching, I got a clear idea of watching their games, Green Bay, and said things like that. You know, when I was in Seattle, there were a few things that I worried about. You know, they knew my weaknesses. So, you know, I didn't want to give up any deep balls. Didn't want to give up the double move. You know, those are the things I was trying to look out for, you know, as far as me being there for 3 years and them knowing me and me knowing them for 3 years.
Brandon Browner. Patriots cornerback, former Seahawks cornerback. But in that very moment, as you're lining up for that play, and I know a lot of things are going through your head, does it occur to you, wait a minute, I've seen this before. I've seen this in practice. I know what they're going to do. Is there a chance they're trying to fool me? Are they actually going to do this? What are you thinking when you reflect on the things you've seen before on film and the things you've seen in practice? Do you think there's a chance they've got some new wrinkle?
Not really. I just knew what they like to do, you know, and in the red zone or any short down and distance. You know, they run the pick concepts well. You know, all you have to do is pick the guy and make the catch, you know, and that's crucial point, you know, on the one. All you have to do is catch the ball. It's 6 points. So.
Your job in that case was to keep Jermaine Kearse from picking Malcolm Butler?
Exactly.
And you did that very well.
Thank you, man.
And no one seems to realize how well you did that. Now, Al Michaels mentioned it the other day, but by keeping Kearse from getting to Butler, Butler was able to get to the ball.
Yeah, and also it takes a lot of guts for Malcolm, you know, go for it. You know, that could have been a double move. You know, it could have been like the route that Julian got them on. You know, he could have banged back out on Malcolm. You know, it took a lot for Malcolm to just shoot it. You know, and trust what he's seen on film. So it's a teamwork thing. You know, I had to press them from getting up to Malcolm, but Malcolm trusts what he's seen and he shot it.
And I noticed how you fired off the ball to keep Curse from getting away from you. And I also noticed one of your trade secrets.
What is it?
I saw your left hand go up to the top of the shoulder pad and prevent Jermaine Curse from getting away. Was that deliberate? Did it just kind of happen on the spur of the moment?
Those things just happen, you know. Honestly, you know, you don't think I'm going to grab him on the top of his. You know, I don't even realize where I grab him, but, you know, in the moment, it's like I got to get him before, he gets me or he picks off Malcolm. So, you know, those are the things that go through your head. Just go. You know, I actually was looking at the ball. My head was turned in towards the ball.
What did you think when Malcolm caught him?
Oh, man, I was excited for him, excited for us as a team. And one thing I can say about Malcolm Butler, he showed the most ball skills, you know, early on from OTAs all the way up until, you know, Super Bowl. He just never picked off a ball in a regular season game, and he picked the right time to show his ball skills to the world. Because, like, throughout OTAs and every practice, Malcolm may have picked off two or three balls a day. You know, and we knew that as a team. It's just, you know, he picked the right time to take one, you know. He picked right time to get his first.
He's Brandon Browner, Patriots cornerback. How surprised were you that they didn't just hand the ball to Marshawn Lynch on that play?
Oh, very surprised. But we knew, you know, by them having three receivers on the field, there's a chance, there's a big chance they can pass the ball. So we had three corners. We were ready. You know, we didn't really have too many linebackers. We were ready for a run and pass.
Have you talked to any of your former Seahawks teammates about the game?
Not yet. Not about the game. We just, as you spoke about, you know, a lot of them guys I found out were injured. You know, I'm going to take a trip to go see some of them guys. Richard just had his baby, so I'm probably going to go see him in about a week and a half. I don't want to talk about the game just yet, you know. Maybe I'll talk about the game when I sit down, you know, personal.
He's Patriots cornerback Brandon Browner, who played for the Seahawks 3 years before jumping over to the Patriots. It seems that Coach Pete Carroll has some concern that there are guys in the locker room who aren't going to ever agree with the play call. Is that a valid concern? Are there guys that you know in the locker room that may have a hard time getting past the decision not to run the ball there?
I think that's normal. You know, of course, there's going to be guys scratching their heads about that decision. You know, ultimately, it could have cost them the Super Bowl ring, but that's a part of the game, you know. You live some, you win some, you lose some. You know, just fortunately, you know, I happen to be on the Pat side of things this year. So that's something they'll have to live with. But I think they'll put it behind them once week one start of regular next season.
Now, at some point, the Patriots are going to be going to the White House. And based on a tweet that I saw you post, you may have something to say to the president.
My goal is accomplished, just getting back there, you know, shaking his hand once again. You know, I was trying to show up the president, but like I said, my goal was just to get back there, which I knew I had a chance when signing with the Patriots.
If the Seahawks secondary is the Legion of Boom, what do we call the Patriots secondary?
The Seahawks secondary was given that name by the fans. You know, I leave that up to the fans. You know, if the fans come up with something cool, you know, that sticks. And I think it'll fit normally, you know. I think that's how it's supposed to go, you know. No self-proclaimed names, you know, I think leave that up to the fans.
Whatever the name may be, if there is a name for next year, will Darrelle Revis be part of it, in your opinion?
I think he will. I think he will, but, you know, ultimately he has to make the best business decision for him and his family.
Wrapping up with Brandon Browner, Patriots cornerback. You have had a very unique football career. Entered the league in 2005, gone from the NFL for 6 years, played in Canada. How do you explain your career looking back on it?
No, I think no different than any other person who worked hard, you know, resilient. You know, it just so happened I had to go to Canada. But I think you talk to any player who's been cut, you know, I think those things that we go through, you know, are what make us, you know, the men we are today. You know, just like at any job, you know, you go through things and make mistakes to learn from, you know. So when that opportunity presents itself again, you know how to deal with it.
How close did you come to giving up on football?
I don't think I was never giving up, but I felt like that last, right before I got signed with the Seahawks, I was like, wow, it's going to take a lot for me to come back up here to Canada, you know, and play because we had no indoor facility. We had to practice outside in the bad weather. You know, every day was like that, so that was kind of tough for me.
So two straight Super Bowl rings for Brandon Browner. Will there be a third straight?
No predictions, but, like, we got a really good football team. So does Seattle. You know, like, I wouldn't doubt the two teams meeting up in the big game again, but we still got a long way to go, and I also like to enjoy this one here for a little bit.
Well, you deserve to enjoy it. Unsung hero from Super Bowl 49, keeping Jermaine Kearse from getting to Malcolm Butler with or without a grab of the shoulder pad, which who cares if they'd have thrown a flag? What is it, a half yard? What's the first down and goal? They have a second and goal. Didn't matter. Smart play. Great job. Thanks for some of your time. Get better, and we hope to talk to you again down the road.
I appreciate it.
There he is, Brandon Browner, playing hurt, playing sick, calling in. I didn't realize he didn't go to the parade. I thought he was sick Thursday from being out in the cold all day long on Wednesday, and who knows how long the party lasted into Wednesday night. But appreciate Brandon making some time, and I wanted to give a chance to praise him directly for what he did in keeping Jermaine Kearse from getting to Malcolm Butler. And when you hear Darrell Bevell, the Seahawks offensive coordinator, say that Ricardo Lockett, the receiver, should have fought through to the ball, he shouldn't have needed to fight through to the ball. Malcolm Butler shouldn't have been there because Jermaine Kearse didn't fight through Brandon Browner. And he didn't fight through Brandon Browner because Brandon Browner knew what was coming. And he knew what was coming because he spent 3 years with the Seahawks and he's seen that play before. How do you not factor that into your game planning? That you got a guy on the other side of the field that has been there, done that, seen it, knows you like to run pick plays, and knows that his job in that situation is to keep Jermaine Kearse from picking Malcolm Butler. Amazing stuff. When we return, let's talk some Seahawks injuries with Mike Ryan, NBC Sports Medicine Analyst. This is PFT Live on NBC Sports Radio. Welcome back to PFT Live on NBC Sports Radio. Great stuff from Patriots cornerback Brandon Browner. He challenges all Patriots fans to come up with a nickname for that secondary. Legion of Boom came from the fans in Seattle. What are the Patriots fans going to come up with? Legion of Boom is boomed up. It's easier to list the guys who don't need surgery than the guys who do. And who better to help us understand the consequences of these various injuries than our good friend Mike Ryan, NBC Sports Medicine Analyst, longtime NFL athletic trainer. Mike, let's start with Earl Thomas, the safety who dislocated a shoulder in the NFC Championship game, torn labrum. How long of a recovery time? How big of a deal is this? The floor is yours.
Well, it's not a big deal at this point, Mike. You never really know what a shoulder looks like until you actually get in there. What he did admit prior to the Super Bowl is that he had a torn labrum. So typically with that surgery, when they go in, they kind of anchor that labrum down. The labrum is almost like a circular rubber bumper, if you will, that kind of makes that shoulder joint a little bit more stable. And because of the dislocation with the injury in the championship game, he'll probably have that shoulder tightened up as well. So the good news for Seahawks fans is this is a fairly common injury and the results are very good. And when you look at this, it's typically a 4 to 6 month rehab process. So kind of OTAs are probably out of the question, but by the time you get halfway through training camp, he should be out there and should do very well with this throughout the season.
We also learned, Mike, in the aftermath of the Super Bowl, that Cam Chancellor has a torn MCL and a deep bone bruise. For the torn MCL, surgery necessary or will it heal with rest?
It'll heal with rest. It's real unusual, Mike, to have surgery and need surgery when it comes to an MCL. And seeing the fact he did play with it in the Super Bowl, it's probably a grade one, maybe a grade two. So that MCL shouldn't be a factor. It's going to heal. It's going to do fine. But here's the real interesting part with Cam regarding that knee is that bone bruise. Then we talked about a couple months ago, Mike, about the articular cartilage and issues that go on with that. when you get a bone bruise, you're getting bleeding in the bone itself. And I've seen bone bruises quiet down in 10 days, and I've seen the pain last for 10 months. So that's the real X factor when it comes to how well he's going to do with this. By him having the injury on Friday and playing in the Super Bowl with a bone bruise, and interesting to know with this being in the lateral compartment, the outside part of the knee itself, Mike, that typically is a little bit slower healer. So MCL is not a factor, but this bone bruise is going to be what they're going to be watching closely throughout the offseason and kind of control his rehab. And he has enough time to let that quiet down, but you're going to have to make sure that that bone bruise is quiet down before he starts pounding on this knee.
So this sounds like one of those rare situations when you say you're okay, it's just a bruise. Not that this is not a bruise that is going to be okay anytime soon.
It isn't, but if they treat it well, it will be. It's one of those things you just kind of wait and see how it does. But is it just a flesh wound, so to speak? No. It's a bone bruise, a swelling in the bone. And to make sure that bone heals properly, you got to give it enough time. I'm sure he's going to have repeat MRIs in this down the road to make sure that swelling has subsided and that bone itself has continued to heal. And that's an important factor in this rehab.
He's Mike Ryan, NBC Sports Medicine Analyst, former NFL athletic trainer. There's a lot of miscommunication and misinformation, Mike, about whether or not Seahawks cornerback Richard Sherman needs surgery on his elbow. Why is there so much confusion, and how long of a recovery process if he doesn't have surgery?
It really is, and there was a lot of stuff flying around in that. Everybody was a little bit confused with it. Typically with a Tommy John injury, what he had, which is the ligament on the inside of the knee, almost think of it as a MCL of the elbow, if you will. But typically for someone who's not a pitcher or a thrower, you have to have a lot of instability in that joint to have to need to go in and have the Tommy John surgery. So, like I said to you there, I'd be very surprised if he did need the surgery, seeing the fact that he's able to play in the Super Bowl with just a sleeve. It wasn't like he had a heavy brace on, kind of like you see J.J. Watt wearing or some of those guys with those big braces that give the joint stability. He didn't need that, so I'd be shocked if he did need surgery down the road. So based on what he has, I know one of the things flying around now is the fact that he may need to have that ulnar nerve relocated, and that's not really a big deal if he does. They just kind of release it, and they kind of flip it out of the groove that it sits in. But, again, that's something they would wait down the road that typically happens if you have a lot of hand nerve issues. And I thought he did an exceptional job playing with that elbow the way it was and used it fairly well in the Super Bowl. So I didn't see a factor here of him having a lot of hand issues and shaking the hand out. So I think the best thing for him is time. Let this quiet down. I think once you get to OTAs, Richard Sherman's elbow issues are a thing of the past.
Last minute or so with Mike Ryan, NBC Sports Medicine Analyst. Aaron Rodgers claims he tore his calf muscle because of substandard turf at Raymond James Stadium in Tampa. Is there any credibility to that?
I don't know that field real well. We haven't been there in a while, but I can tell you I've had players who've had calf issues that have come from bad fields. I've had guys who have torn their ACLs. I have a great picture of a player who was playing in an old field, and there was a picture of him standing there making a cut. You could only see the very top of his laces because his shoe was completely subsided in the turf, and that's the exact moment he tore his ACL. So turf has a big impact on what happens, whether this is an issue with Aaron, that particular turf created his issue, but bad fields can create soft tissue injuries, so I would not be shocked by that claim.
Well, Mike, great stuff. Thanks, as always, for some of your time. We'll be talking to you again down the road.
My pleasure, Mike. Have a great weekend.
You too, buddy. Mike Ryan, NBC Sports Medicine Analyst. The conversation continues. Pick up your phone. Call us 855-323-4NBC. We'll be back with more after this. Welcome back to PFT Live on NBC Sports Radio. This program is brought to you by O'Reilly Auto Parts. Sign up to be an O Rewards member today and start earning instantly. Earn $5 back for every $150 you spend. It's fast, easy, and free, and only at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Better parts, better prices every day. Our next guest spent many years putting the parts together of a football team and recently earned a spot in the Pro Football Hall of Fame for his contributions to the game as an executive and general manager. He is new Hall of Famer Ron Wolf, and he's on the program now. Ron, congratulations on the induction, and how are you?
I'm doing well, and thanks very much for the congratulations. It's an honor that is, to me, very awesome. I'm sure that my feet are still not on the ground after I found out about it, and it's one of those things that a person like myself never imagines has an opportunity to occur, but it did, and I'm very grateful for that.
Where were you when you got the news?
I was in my hotel room per instructions, and they ask you to stay in your room and wait till somebody calls you or there's a knock on the door. And I never got the call, but I got the knock on the door. And it was a big sigh of relief to find out that you're actually in.
You open the door. Who's there?
David Baker, the president of the Hall of Fame. He's there with two or three guys holding TV cameras. And it's one of those things. There's a long waiting period, so you can't imagine the angst with all that. And then suddenly, now it's over, so you can breathe a sigh of relief. And I'm talking about myself, it's very elated. Because you can think of all the people that have an opportunity to be, or this is one of the great things in the United States, I think. Everybody has a person or players or people who should be in the Hall of Fame. And to actually get there, to represent a team and to have your name associated with the greats of the game is a remarkable occurrence.
He's Ron Wolf, new Hall of Famer, made his biggest impact as Packers general manager. Give me the name of one person that you would put in the Hall of Fame right now who isn't in there but you think should be.
Well, there are so many people that are certainly qualified. I think everybody has one or two. With the Packers, there were several former Packers. But to me, the one guy that deserves to be in there is a guy by the name of Clark Shaughnessy, who founded the T formation, if you will, and then spent the next 50 years stopping it. And, in fact, my first year with the Packers, I went over to Minneapolis to watch the Redskins and the Bills play in the Super Bowl. And there is Clark Shaughnessy's defense. That's 1992 on the field and under Richie Pettibone and the Redskins. So he found the T formation in the 40s, and here it is in the 90s. It's still going strong.
He's Ron Wolf, new Hall of Famer, former Packers general manager. One of your biggest accomplishments of the many that you had as Packers GM was persuading defensive end Reggie White to come to Green Bay. That was the moment many looked to that changed the perception of the franchise, laid the foundation for a Super Bowl win. What was the thing that closed the deal with Reggie White?
I think it was the fact that we offered more money than anybody else. You know, I would like to say it was some big trick or some move that we made that was the other teams couldn't counter, but I think it was the money.
How sure were you that he was going to be the real thing for the Packers?
Well, I don't know how sure, but this is without a doubt the top free agent ever in the history of the game. Either he or Deion Sanders. You can argue that any way you want to argue that. But he was just a great football player. And for him to cast his lot with our football team spoke volumes to the rest of the people in those players in and around the National Football League. So, you know, Mike Holmgren, Ray Rose, Mike Reinfeldt, they're all guys that did a tremendous job of recruiting him. And as I said, they got the job done, and we became Super Bowl champions.
You mentioned Mike Holmgren. He was the head coach when you were the GM, and we have Ron Wolf here on PFT Live and NBC Sports Radio. We've seen so many examples, Ron, recently where coaches and GMs can't get along and we have mutual partings. How is it that GMs and coaches suddenly are having a hard time coexisting?
You know, I've been out 15 years now, so I don't know. I find that a remarkable occurrence, because really and truly, you're in this thing together, and the two of you have to make this work. The only people that are going to get credit or the blame are the head coach and the general manager. So you better have a good working relationship with one another, because it's about the team. It's not about you personally. This is what I sold in Green Bay. Remember, fellas, I would always tell our guys, it's about the Packers. It's not about you. It's not my pick. It's not your pick. It's our pick. Everything we do is about the Packers. And I would look at it the same way with these individuals. It's got to be about the team. It's a team game. And I'm just amazed and shocked when I read that people are having a hard time getting along with one another.
He's Ron Wolf, new Hall of Famer, former Packers GM. I would be remiss not to ask you to tell a Brett Favre story. What's your favorite Brett Favre story?
I think what he keeps asking for left-handed footballs. You know, I think those are asking the ball guy. You know, you got any left-handed footballs? I think that's Brett Favre in a nutshell. The fact that the thing about Brett Favre, I'm sure people are probably tired of hearing about Brett Favre, but I could talk about him forever. The thing about Brett Favre is he never missed a game. Playing a game was very important to him, and he never missed one, which is remarkable when you think about the position he played and the shots he took, and because he was supposed to be a little bit tougher than other people. He didn't get some of those calls that some of those guys get nowadays that are playing that position. But just a great, great football player.
He's Ron Wolf, former Packers GM. Your son Elliot now working with the Green Bay Packers seems to be on that same path you were. And it may be hard for you to be completely objective about this. I know it would be hard for me, but how close do you think Elliot is to being ready to be a GM of his own?
I'm going to have to pass on that. I can only go with what my guys tell me. You know, I've got five guys that are general managers in the league, five of 29 are GMs, and a couple of them tell me he's a better talent evaluator than I was, which wouldn't be difficult, but he is, and they tell me he's ready to make that step. Now, he's not very old, but he has a great deal of experience. The thing I'm most proud of him is he did this all after I left the game, and I had absolutely no influence on any of his promotions or his jobs. He did it himself. So he's got to have a building. Now he's the number two guy in the Packers.
And he'll be presenting you in Canton later this year at the Hall of Fame. Congratulations again, Ron, on the honor, and all the best. We hope to talk to you again down the road.
Okay. Thank you very much for having me.
Ron Wolf, new Hall of Famer, will be introduced for induction by his son, Elliot, who most likely will at some point be a general manager. And if that assessment is correct, then Elliot Wolf may be entering the Hall of Fame someday, many years from now, and hopefully I'll still be around for that. Well, all right, thanks for joining us. Great week. We'll be back Monday with more, unless they cancel us, which is always possible. Have a great weekend. Check us out at ProFootballTalk.com. Stats get better. See you.